A number of adjectives have been used to describe the general tone of 2016. Agonizing is one, unforgiving is another, and while we're at it, it was also miserable, relentless, ugly, and mostly depressing. But despite the year's ceaseless parade of celebrity deaths and the kind of political vitriol fit for a dystopia, 2016 did offer its fair share of quality films. Hi, I'm Nathan Weinbender, and on this week's Movies 101, Dan Webster, Mary Pat Truthart, and I are going to dig into our individual choices for the year's best cinematic offerings, finding a few silver linings in the rain cloud that was 2016. Will we all agree, or will we throw punches about whether The Lobster was actually any good? So get out your pencils, because a recommendation-filled Movies 101 is coming up next, right here on Spokane Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Kerry Boyce, GM of Spokane Public Radio. You've probably noticed that the world is getting smaller. Events and actions across the state, nation, and world impact our news, our lives, and our very future. Spokane Public Radio pays a high price to bring you the news, cultural programs, and the best possible radio, so you know what's going on, so that our citizens and our decisions are well informed. For us, this mission is a public trust, and you have our pledge to make the best of that trust and the resources you place with us. If you pledged before, thank you. And if you haven't, there is no better time than right now.
Hi, I'm Nathan Weinbender, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and staff writer for the Spokesman Review.
And I'm Dan Webster, also film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga Law School.
And welcome to Movies 101, where we're finally going to stick a fork in the year that was. We're going to take a break from reviewing new films this week and look back on the previous 12 months of cinema with our individual choices for the best 10 movies of 2016. Now, compiling these kinds of lists can be the bane of a film critic's existence. How are you supposed to pick just 10? And besides, isn't the ranking a little bit arbitrary? But it also helps you put hundreds of hours of movie going into some kind of tidy context. In this first half of the show, Dan, Mary, Pat, and I are going to discuss the handful of films that appeared on all three of our lists. In the second half, we'll talk about the outliers, the films each of us deemed year-end worthy that neither of our co-hosts bothered to even mention. But before all that, let's talk about the year as a whole. Do you guys think that 2016, for all of the things, the bad things that happened, in terms of film, do you think this was a successful year?
I think there were a few gems. Overall, I did not find this year to be a celebration of cinema the way maybe the past year, 2015, was. And so I ended up being a little disappointed and having to struggle just a tad to come up with a top list.
I didn't have any trouble coming up with a top list. In fact, I came up with something like 20 films that I thought were okay. However, overall, if we look at the year, there were maybe three or four what I consider films that are almost great. Beyond that, it's a B minus of a year.
And I think this was a year for television.
Yes.
Because I think the series format, the multiple episode television presentation of either narrative or documentary in particular won the day as far as I'm concerned.
And we had some, I kind of pushed back on that because Dan originally wanted to put a couple of TV series and miniseries in his top 10, and
I balked.
I've seen O.J. Made in America, which I gave sort of a mention to on my top 10 article that I wrote for the newspaper, because I think it's a stellar use of film. I also think that it's an 8-hour television miniseries. Even though it did play in select theaters, that's not how most people saw it. We saw it week by week.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a different art form, because once you put that on the list, then hey, why not put the American Crime Story,
then
the narrative
some year,
one
what
on
we're
going
to have to do is do a second show and just do that, because these are getting better and better.
Yeah.
And by far better than many of the movies we saw.
And I would agree with you that 2016 was somewhat of a letdown when compared with 2015, which had Mad Max Fury Road and Carol and Spotlight and just movie after movie that really came at us and wowed us. This year was really backloaded. It took until maybe October that we started seeing movies on a regular basis that were actually worth talking about.
Right. So, well, let's start with one of those. We came up with four that we all agreed upon.
Right.
Okay.
Dan, this is the first time this has happened in quite a few years. We both agree on the best film of 2016, which is Barry Jenkins' Moonlight. And that showed up on all three of our top 10
lists. By far. This is not only the best movie of the year, it may be the best movie of the decade.
I might not quibble with that.
It's certainly on any top 10 list. When we read about these movies beforehand, you can't avoid the hype. And you know, living in Spokane, we usually get the movie sometime 2-3 weeks, sometimes a month afterward. And this movie got a lot of hype. People were just over the moon about it. So I was all set to go, yeah, it's just going to be another disappointing movie. By the time this movie was over, I went, it's worth every single bit. By saying that, I don't want to oversell it because I want people to go and just let the movie
discover
work.
Discover it, right.
It is an amazing film.
And I think it's an amazing film for a variety of reasons. One, it has some basis in fact. And so there's this authenticity to Moonlight that is hard to replicate if someone were truly coming from an outside perspective. So that's number one. The acting performances, especially by Mahershala Ali.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Close enough.
And Naomi Harris were certainly notable. And I think that's being underscored
and
by
them. And all of the three boys that played this character, Chiron, at three different ages, Alex Hibbert, Ashton Sanders, and Trevante Rhodes, they don't necessarily look like each other physically, except in their eyes, but each captured this kid and his struggle, I thought, perfectly.
Yeah, it's a very poetic film, and I'm kind of a sucker for coming-of-age dramas anyway. I mean, you remember how gaga I was over Richard Linklater's Boyhood a few years
ago.
Right,
and you're still coming of age.
Exactly. I think, aren't we all, Dan? But this movie, I mean, it really ups the stakes for any kind of narrative about this sort of thing from here on out. Another one of the movies that we all agreed was amongst the best. Dan, you have this at number two on your list. And boy, you're learning every day because it's number two on my list too. It's like you copied my list. Was Kenneth Lonergan's Manchester by the Sea, which is a movie about big, tricky subjects, much like Moonlight was. It's about grief. It's about death. It's about loss. It's about connecting with other people. And yet it manages to be so much more than just a bunch of big themes. This is a movie that felt lived in. It felt real. And that's not something we often get in movies.
And I think that, again, we're sort of looking at the contrast between the film itself and the way it was shot. We're looking at the acting performances. And then we're ultimately looking at the story. And so for films to bring all three of those components together is something that I think we really do need to showcase on any sort of top 10 list. Because Manchester by the Sea had amazing acting performances, most notably by Casey Affleck, but also by the newcomer,
Lucas Hedges, who plays his nephew.
Yeah.
And I think he's the real revelation here because I'd never seen him before, and he's great in this movie.
And let's not forget the small but important role that Michelle Williams plays in this film. You know, again, Manchester by the Sea. I don't want to oversell this movie because this is a movie that should sneak up on you. It's one you should go in and go, well, I've heard about this. I wonder if it's going to be any good. And then when you walk out, you go, I'm going to be thinking about this movie for the next couple of days because I particularly have never seen a movie that handles overwhelming grief in such a believable and yet forgiving manner.
And a humorous manner, too, because this movie is disarmingly funny. I also want to say that the way Kenneth Lonergan puts movies together makes him a really distinct filmmaker. He's one of those guys, he, like the movie, kind of sneaks up on you because the way that the story of Manchester by the Sea plays out, it goes off in so many different directions to the point where sometimes you're sitting in the theater going, what does this have to do with anything at all? And yet it all comes together and you wouldn't want any of those seemingly unnecessary scenes to be cut out because they add so much to the fabric of the film. All right, well, moving on, another movie that is on all three of our lists. I feel like there's not this much crossover in our list typically, so we're all agreeing on the very, very best.
When we get into the second half of the show, we'll get to it.
Yeah, maybe I'm overstating that. Yeah. Let's talk about Arrival, which was number three on my list, number four on your list, Dan. We should say that Mary Pat didn't number her list. Did you feel like that was just too arbitrary? Or?
I guess, and, you know, so alphabetical seemed like a way to go.
So
here.
Arrival was second on your list.
Arrival's number one on your list.
No, 13th.
We could talk about that. Yeah. So Arrival actually was a pretty big box office success, surprisingly so. It's the newest film from director Denis Villeneuve, and it's basically an alien invasion movie, but it's about a lot more than that. This was a movie that, up until I saw Moonlight Manchester by the Sea, was comfortably at number one on my list. I thought this was really something else. I've heard from other people that it didn't quite connect with them, but it really connected with me, I mean, emotionally and intellectually.
Yeah, exactly. It's an alien invasion movie with a heart. you know, mm-hmm. and a mind also. Like
and it's interesting because I know that at least Dan and I read the short story on which it was based, and it is simultaneously true to that story and differs from it mm-hmm. in ways that I think were legit in terms of its film incarnation. But I thought, again, you know, I'm not into the alien genre right. of films. And the fact that I was willing to tout this one, I think in and of itself speaks to the fact that it's more than just your typical alien film. So Arrival did work for me, but I agree with you, Nathan. I've gotten some real pushback from people.
Okay, it's not just me.
No, who were saying, that was horrible. Yeah. I almost walked out. And I was like, oh, okay.
I don't care.
I mean, you should stick to your guns, right? I mean, I think it is deeply emotional. And if the third act reversal that this movie employs doesn't work for you, if you see it as a stunt and not as, you know, just the organic flow of the story, then the whole thing falls apart, right? But if it clicks with you, then everything comes
alive.
And
then you need to go out and rent Independence Day Resurgence. It's quite simple.
And realize how not to make an alien invasion movie.
Absolutely. So the last one.
Yeah, this is the last movie that we all agreed on, and then the harmony the harmony that we've created is going to break, because then it will be nothing but disagreements. That would be Damien Chazelle's La La Land, which we reviewed on the show last week. You may recall that we actually had sort of a scuffle over this one, and yet here it is on all three of our top 10 lists. Dan, you were the biggest champion of this, and it's number 3 on your list. It's number 5 on mine.
Right.
Why don't you talk about why this movie works so well?
The very first movie I ever remember seeing was Singing in the Rain. I was 5 years old. It's an amazing movie. And this is not Singing in the Rain, because Singing in the Rain has a lightness to it. This is a movie that's much closer to Jacques Demy's 1964 film Umbrellas of Cherbourg, because it's about love blooming, love glowing, love fading, and then love lost. It ultimately is a downer of a movie, but it's done in such a way that's light and the music is good. That opening sequence is one of the best sequences I've ever seen put on film in terms of being almost a single take. I think there's 2 cuts in the entire 6-minute sequence. I love the performances. I love the story. And I loved how at the end it both captures reality, the heartbreak, and yet at the same time gives you an alternate storyline that allows you to walk out feeling happy also. I just loved everything about La La Land.
I agree that overall this film really does work. I thought there were a few weaknesses here and there, but that does not detract ultimately from the power and the uniqueness, at least for this era and generation, of this particular film. And I liked seeing Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling playing these different parts than we're accustomed to seeing them play in other contexts.
And, you know, what's that old John Ford rule that a good movie is 3 great scenes and no bad ones? I mean, I think La La Land fits that criteria, even though I did have problems with it. The 3 great scenes in this movie are really, really great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so much for agreement. With that, I think it's time that we should take a break. Before we go, let me remind you that you can hear podcasts of past episodes of Movies 101, as well as the reviews that Dan and I write at SpokanePublicRadio.org. When we return, we'll continue our look at 2016 in film here on Spokane Public Radio.
Stars, are you shining just for me? City of stars, there's so much that I can't see. Who knows? I felt it from the first embrace I shared with you.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Nathan Weinbender. During the first half of the show, Dan Webster, Mary Pat Truthart, and I were discussing our choices for the best films of 2016, a year that was, to put it mildly, a bit tumultuous. We all agreed that Moonlight, Manchester by the Sea, Arrival, and La La Land were at the top of the cinematic heap. But why don't we focus now on disagreements? What I want to do is look at all three of our lists, which we will read complete at the end of the show.
And then it will be posted.
Be posted on SpokanePublicRadio.org so you can see them. I want to look at all three of our lists and talk about the films that each of us thought were amongst the 10 best that are co-host did not list at all or didn't like or for whatever reason decided to exclude it. So, Dan, why don't you tell us about your outlier and why you thought this movie was any good, because I'd like to hear you defend this
one. Right, exactly. Well, first of all, the movie we're talking about is Ang Lee's adaptation of the novel Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. And first, I always have trouble being objective about what I consider to be decent looks at war and the veterans' experience. And I think that's what this was. Are there problems with Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk? Yes. Ang Lee shot it in this very fast kind of format, an experimental format, and it doesn't work. We didn't get to see it in that format, and 90% of Americans didn't see it. So
probably
I don't even know what the point of it was. Yeah. But the storyline itself, I liked. I liked the characters. I liked what Kristen Stewart did. I liked the fact that the movie is not just simply a jingoistic look at veterans and, and rah, rah, rah. It's a look at how veterans can be, in this particular case, exploited during the halftime of basically a Dallas Cowboys show. Our soldiers and sailors and airmen, we throw them in the fight and we laud them, and then they come home and we forget them. And so there were so many emotions working for me. I couldn't not put Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk on my top 10 list.
Yeah, it was not a movie I was a fan of, but I mean, I can't argue with anything you're saying. I think
that's why I argued that
framed
way.
It as such. Yes, yeah, exactly. I mean, it was a personal film for you.
I'm wrapping myself in the flag.
Based on your own experiences and based on the fact that you push back against, like you said, the jingoism that seems to substitute for patriotism.
Yes. Yeah, no, that's a really good way of putting it, Mary Pat. I think that the movie's heart was in the right place. It had interesting ideas. I just think Ang Lee kind of tripped over his own feet on this one. I thought the execution just didn't work. As some kind of satire, it wasn't biting enough. As a drama, I thought it was a bit too hectoring. And yeah, the stylistic gymnastics that he was using here, I found just kind of baffling. But hey, it either works for you or it doesn't, I guess. Mary Pat, which movie on your list would you like to defend?
Well, I'm going to defend Hunt for the Wilder People because it was not a perfect film by any means, but it's shot in New Zealand and it's about a boy who was in foster care and he finds himself in a new family and then things sort of spiral out. But I'm sorry, how could you not put a film that has a dog named Tupac on your list? I mean, that's just enough said.
It finally comes out. Now we know why she put it on her top 10 list.
No, I thought
the resident Tupac fan.
Right. The performances by Sam Neill and the boy Julian Dennison, I thought were heartwarming, heartfelt, a little stereotyped at different points, but then it goes in a completely different direction than you anticipate. And I think this is a film well worth watching.
Yeah, I put Hunt for Wilder People on my second 10 list, so I can't argue anything you're saying. It might easily have replaced one of the films on my list, so yeah, I think you're right. I really did like this movie.
I liked it, too. I actually saw it at the Seattle International Film Festival. It was the last movie I saw after a long week.
It was a big hit there, wasn't it?
And it played like gangbusters to a sold-out crowd. I've rarely heard a crowd in a movie theater react so obviously positively towards a film. And so I thought that once it actually hit limited release that it would kind of break out and that people would see it. And it didn't really do much business over here. It kind of fizzled. And I wonder why that is. Maybe because it was considered a foreign film, even though Sam Neill's been in some of the biggest box office hits of all time.
Yep.
But it's really worth checking out. I think it's a movie that could develop something of a cult following over the years because it does have a very specific kind of style
and
to
it. And now, come on, I want to hear yours, Nathan.
Okay, the movie that I am going to defend, my outlier. I actually have four movies on my list that neither of you included, but I am going to defend The Lobster. And believe it or not, Dan, I have heard from other people after I published my list that this movie didn't work for them either. So you are not alone. Yet lots of other critics put this movie on their top tens too.
Did,
so
yes,
I'm not alone either.
But
I think that right there explains the weird tone of this movie. It's by a Greek director named Yorgos Lanthimos. I urge you to check out one of his previous films, Dogtooth, which is one of the weirdest, grossest, most explicit, somehow funniest movies I've ever seen about alienation and brainwashing. And I don't know how to explain it other than well, just go watch it. If you have a strong stomach, I suppose. The Lobster was sort of this weird allegorical fantasy, science fiction, comedy sort of thing in which single people have 45 days to find a romantic partner. Otherwise, they're going to be turned into an animal of their choosing. It's almost like a weird fairy tale. And Colin Farrell plays a guy who has recently gone through a breakup and goes to this weird seaside resort and decides that if he can't find anyone there that he wants to couple with, he's going to become a lobster because he's always liked the sea.
And they live for like 80
years. And lobsters
live
for a long time.
And they have sex all the time.
Right. Yeah. And then it kind of goes off halfway through to follow this like militia camp that's in the woods. This movie is either going to work for you or it isn't. It's kind of got this clinical style about it. It's incredibly deadpan. I thought it was really funny and really strange and singular. And at the end, I think actually has something to say about the way that our society treats romantic relationships and monogamy. And Dan just made eyes at me.
A face that could not really be duplicated. And I didn't see The Lobster. And so now, of course, I have
to
see
it. So I'm right
to break the tie.
Obviously, because, you know, I'm the host, so my opinion goes.
Yeah.
So, Dan, I mean, I remember when we reviewed this on the show and we disagreed, but it still doesn't work for you.
I just didn't get it. I think that it's really a well-made movie. I love movies that go off into fantastic, very strange. Normally, I do. But when The Lobster was finally done, I went, what the hell was that about? I didn't get it. And it has such a weird ending that fell to me out of tune with the humor that I agree there was humor in it.
I will admit that I cannot explain the ending. So, yeah. I don't know.
See, I put this in the list of, I was going to say, worst films of the year, but then I changed that. I thought
most
that was really
befuddling.
Tough. Yeah. Most mind-bending films. And for me, that goes right along with Swiss Army Man. And the Neon Demon. Excuse me, the Neon Demon, the one with Elle Fanning.
Well, I didn't like either of those, but I still like The Lobster. Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know what's going on. These are all weird movies. And like I said, they're either going to click with you or they aren't. Dan, I also wanted to point out a movie that's on your list that is on my runners-up, but I had a lot of affection for, which was Love and Friendship, the Whit Stillman movie. I feel like that one, it came out early in the year, I feel like that one's kind of fallen by the wayside, but that's a really, really good
film.
Absolutely,
and it is Kate Beckinsale's best performance ever. I mean, here's a woman who absolutely has talent, stage talent. She is that kind of living up to the auspices of great British acting. Mm-hmm. And yet she's done these underworld movies for years.
One is in theaters right now,
Yeah, to put her kids through school or whatever. She came out and she kicked a butt in this movie. She is so good as a woman we hate.
And Tom Bennett in a great supporting
role.
And we're going to go through our lists. Before we do that, though, Mary Pat, both you and I put Richard Linklater's Everybody Wants Some on our top tens, which Dan neglected. So I want to say kudos to you for remembering that movie.
Yes, I agree. Mm. I thought it was a fun movie
and too.
I enjoyed it.
No, all right. So now we're going to go around and go through our individual lists from bottom to top, I suppose, or in Mary Pat's case, alphabetically. So why don't you start, Mary Pat? Give us your top 10 films of 2016.
Yes, maybe it's too close in time to grading for me to grade these particular movies. So my list, 13th, the documentary by Ava DuVernay, Arrival, Everybody Wants Some, Fences, The Handmaiden, Hunt for the Wilder People, Kubo and the Two Strings, La La Land, Manchester by the Sea, and Moonlight.
All right, Dan, your list.
And I begin with Moonlight in order. Moonlight, Manchester by the Sea, La La Land, Arrival, Jackie, Loving, a film that none of us talked about, and I know, Nathan, you didn't particularly care for it. And Mary Pat, I'm very weirded out that you didn't like it, but I thought it was an amazing movie by Jeff Nichols. Number 7 was Fences, 8 Patterson, 9 Love and Friendship, and number 10, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk.
All right, and my list, I'm going from bottom to top this time. Number 10, The Edge of 17, really good coming-of-age film.
Agree.
The South Korean film, The Handmaiden, at number 9. Number 8, The Lobster. Number 7, the punk rock thriller, Green Room. Number 6, Everybody Wants Some. Number 5, La La Land. Number 4, For Shame, both of you for forgetting about this one. Hell or High Water. Number 3, Arrival. Number 2, Manchester by the Sea. And the best film of the year, I think, bar none, is Barry Jenkins' Moonlight. And with that, that'll do it for Movies 101. That was our look at films of 2016. We'll return next week, same time and channel, to catch up on a number of new releases. Will any of those make our top 10 lists in 2017? Until then, take to heart this quote from Mahershala Ali in Moonlight, the year's best movie. At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you're going to be. Can't let nobody make that decision for you. You're listening to Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.